Reforming America's Marijuana Prohibition Laws takes education, lobbying, and voting. From Washington, D.C. to your state capitol to your city hall, marijuana law reform involves all levels of civic life. Learn how you can make your impact with elected officials as we take a look at our government at work.
Today at Government at Work, we're going to look at the federal level where the Senate Homeland Security Committee heard testimony from four people about the war on drugs. Two pro, two con, I guess you would say. And we're going to give you one of the pros, and I mean pro as in supporter and pro as in professional. It's the head of the Drug Policy Alliance, Dr. Ethan Nadelman, who, in my estimation, is one of two or three of the top speakers on our issue. We'll give you his testimony here and then some anti-testimony in hour two.
Our next witness is Dr. Ethan Nadelman. Dr. Nadelman is the founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, the leading organization in the U.S. promoting alternatives to the war on drugs. Dr. Nadelman.
Well, thank you, Senator Johnson, for initiating this roundtable and for inviting me. I've been waiting for the opportunity for a long time to share some of my thoughts with members of the U.S. Senate. Let me just be frank. I fundamentally believe that the war on drugs in this country and around the world has been a monumental disaster. It's been a disaster in public health terms, it's been a disaster in public safety terms, it's been a disaster in fiscal terms, it's been a disaster in human rights terms, right? I appreciate you bringing up the analogy to alcohol prohibition before, because, you know, you look back at alcohol prohibition, some of what led the nation to embrace the 18th Amendment back then was the notion that alcohol was a horrific drug that was causing immense devastation in this country and what have you. And people embarked upon the experiment of national prohibition. What happened? We saw Al Capone and rising levels of organized crime. We saw all sorts of violence and bootleggers at the borders with Canada and Mexico and all around the country. We saw overflowing jail cells and courthouses. We saw hundreds of thousands of Americans being blinded and poisoned and killed by bad bootleg liquor, liquor that was more dangerous because it was illegal. We saw people talking about, you know, nullifying elements of the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution. We saw levels of corruption that were unparalleled in many parts of the country. You know, we saw Chicago and other towns essentially taken over by the narco traffickers of the day, the alcohol bootleggers, and we saw a rising level of cynicism and disregard for the law. You know what else we saw? We didn't see any reduction in alcohol consumption. At the beginning, it looked like it was going to drive down alcohol use, but by the end of alcohol prohibition, alcohol use was as high at the end of alcohol prohibition as it had been at the beginning. And the major switch was that people had shifted from beer and wine to hard liquor, oftentimes underground hard liquor that was more dangerous. That's why the country came to its senses and said, enough of this, we're repealing alcohol prohibition. At the same time, many countries in Europe that were flirting with prohibition, they looked at us, they saw Al Capone, they saw all the money going down the drain, all the failures, all the hypocrisy. They said, we're not going to do that. We're going to crack down on booze with higher taxes and tougher licensing restrictions and public education campaigns. You know what happened in Europe with that? Without prohibiting alcohol, they drove down alcohol use and alcohol abuse further than we did at the beginning of alcohol prohibition in the United States. And rather than putting billions of pounds and guilders or whatever it might be into the hands of traffickers and gangsters, they put it into government treasuries. Seems to me that was the better approach then. There's a lot to be learned. Fast forward to right now. Drug prohibition has been a monumental disaster. You mentioned, you know, what's going on in Mexico and places like that. Afghanistan was going down in Colombia, parts of Central America. They are like Al Capone in Chicago times 50. It's a result of a failed prohibitionist policy. Then you look at what's happened in American prisons. What are we, less than 5% of the world's population, but almost 25% of the world's incarcerated populations, the highest rate of incarceration in the history of democratic societies, a rate of incarcerating black people in this country that puts South Africa during apartheid or the Soviet gulags to shame. It's nothing to be proud of, and it turned out to be remarkably ineffective in dealing with the problems of drug abuse. Then you look at the public health side. You know, though, when HIV started to spread among injecting drug users back in the 1980s, those countries, not just Australia and the Netherlands, but Margaret Thatcher's Britain, decided that needle exchange programs were the right thing to do. They succeeded in keeping their HIV rates among injecting drug users under 5%. In America, we said, no way, no way, no way, and we ended up killing 100,000 to 200,000 people in this country, not just injecting drug users, but their lovers and their kids. That was a disaster as well. So I think that this war on drugs has just served this country so poorly. I think what happened is we developed an addiction. It was an addiction to drug war thinking, drug war ideology, and drug war policies. And right now, finally, thankfully, the country is finally in recovery from the drug war addiction of our past. Now, that said, in making the analogy to alcohol prohibition, I think it applies mightily to the issue of marijuana prohibition. And if I'd been coaching that 7-year-old who asked you that question that day that you spoke in that school, I would have said, you know, Senator, let me tell you something. During marijuana, I don't see any evidence that the marijuana laws are preventing young people from getting it or any evidence of preventing older people from getting it. All I see is evidence that it's putting a lot of people in jail and costing the government a lot of money. Do you still support a marijuana prohibition policy, knowing that it's been totally ineffective? But with the other drugs, I think this is the way to think about it. And I'm going to conclude my comments with this. I think the best drug policy, what it tries to do is it starts with the understanding that there's never been a drug-free society, more or less in human history. And there's never going to be a drug-free society. If anything, we're going to see more drugs, legal, illegal, in between, gray market in the future, from pharmaceutical companies, underground manufacturers, you name it. Therefore, our challenge is not to try to keep drugs at bay, to build a wall or a moat between this country and others, between our schools and what have you. That's failed. The evidence is in. What we have to do is accept the fact, sadly, that drugs are here to stay and that our great challenge is to learn how to live with them, so they cause the least possible harm and, in some cases, the greatest possible good. Therefore, think about drug policy in the two following ways. The first is that the optimal drug policy should try to do two things. It should seek to reduce the negative consequences of drug use, the death, the disease, the crime, and the suffering, the devastation of families and individuals and communities. It should seek to reduce the harms of drugs. And secondly, it must seek to reduce the harms of government policies, reduce the mass incarceration and the drug gangs out abroad and all of the negative health consequences and violations of civil liberties and human rights. The optimal drug policy is the one that most successfully reduces both the harms of drugs and the harms of government policies. And the second frame, and I'll finish with this, I think it's helpful because all change essentially is incremental in these areas and most others, is to think about our options as a rate along a spectrum. From the most punitive drug policies on the one hand, the Saudi Arabia, Singapore, you know, Malaysia, cut off your hands, execute you, lock them up, drug test you without cause, and throw you into what are called treatment camps, they're really prisons, all the way down to the most free market, Milton Friedman-esque, you know, policies with no restrictions except, you know, to keep kids away. The way we need to think about drug policy is moving down this spectrum. From the highly punitive over-reliance on the criminal law and the criminal justice institutions, moving incrementally, step by step, down this spectrum, but stopping short at the point at which going any further would actually entail real risk to public health or public safety. And it means being driven by the evidence of the sort that Dr. McDonald just referenced to. When the evidence shows that mandatory minimum sentences are not having an effective deterrent impact, then it's time to reform it or repeal those. When the evidence shows that marijuana has useful medical purposes, it's time to acknowledge that. When the evidence shows that providing sterile syringes to injecting drug users through pharmacies or needle exchange programs reduces the spread of HIV/AIDS and hep C without increasing drug use, it's time to do that. When the evidence shows that methadone maintenance and buprenorphine maintenance are successful in reducing the harms of addiction and helping people get their lives together, it's time to do that. When the evidence shows that heroin maintenance and safe injection sites reduce all sorts of harms and produce a net benefit, it's time to do that. With marijuana legalization, we'll see. My judgment is that the net benefits of moving the direction of the sensible regulation of marijuana exceed the risks. That's a judgment, and we'll see how that works out, but I think that the evidence overwhelmingly suggests the right way to go. With the other drugs, we need to move towards a decriminalization public health approach and focus, and this is what I'll do in my comments later, on reducing the demand and the magnitude for demand in these drugs. So long as there is a demand, there will be a supply. Pouring money into supply just pushes it from one place to another, like trying to bang down on mercury or step down on a balloon. It's about reducing demand in ways that are driven by the evidence and respect for basic human decency. Thank you.
That's Drug Policy Alliance Executive Director Ethan Nadelman speaking to the U.S. Senate's Homeland Security Committee. We've got more of that testimony from the Homeland Security Committee. We're going to hear some of the anti-testimony. And we'll definitely have our finger on the pause button so we can hack it up. But that's coming up in hour two. Coming up next, we've got time for a radical rant. We're going to take a look at Washington State and how Mark Kleiman has instituted a Soviet economy in the marijuana markets in Washington State. We're back in just 2 minutes. Stick around.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.